Kentucky, says, I think the Supreme Court is very unlikely to side with Donald Trump, and part of it is the nature of the executive privilege. It's a power belonging to the president. Jonathan Shoup said, it's hard to see how a former president could exercise constitutional power under a theory where all the constitutional powers are vested in the current president. So I think Donald Trump is very likely to lose, or the court may not take the case. Members on the Select Committee note that several courts, the U.S. District Court and the U.S. Appeals Court, have already ruled that Joe Biden has the final say over which White House documents are subject to executive privilege, and that the panel has a legislative purpose. Members believe a victory for the Select Committee at the Supreme Court is important not only because it would give them access to the records that Donald Trump has fought so hard to keep hidden, but because it would supercharge the inquiry with crucial momentum. The Select Committee got its first break when House investigators obtained from Mark Meadows thousands of communications involving the White House, including a PowerPoint presentation detailing ways to stage a coup, and are hoping the Supreme Court can help to sustain their pace. Kate Shaw, a former Obama White House counsel and now a professor of law at Cardozo School of Law, says, it's pretty clear that these documents are serious documents that shed light on the president's activities on 6th of January, and that may be quite damaging for Donald Trump. Kate Shaw added, they could make a difference to the record being compiled by the committee, and thus they could give the process additional momentum. Kate Shaw said, that's probably why Donald Trump is resisting their release as hard as he is. More generally, the Select Committee says they are unconcerned by attempts by Trump aides and political operatives to stymie the inquiry, since Democrats control Washington and the panel has an unprecedented carte blanche to upturn every inch of the Trump administration. Congressman Jamie Raskin, a member of the Select Committee, said, the legislative and executive branches are completely in agreement with each other that this material is not privileged and needs to be turned over to Congress. Things have been moving much more quickly, but the Select Committee acknowledges privately that they face a longer and more difficult slog with Trump aides and political operatives who are mounting legal challenges to everything from the panel's attempts to compel production of call records and even testimony. The trouble for the Select Committee, regardless of Democrats controlling the White House, Congress, and the Justice Department, is that they're counting on the courts to deliver accountability for Trump officials unwilling to cooperate with the inquiry. Yet Donald Trump and his officials know that slow-moving cogs of justice have a history of doing nothing of the sort. House investigators only heard from former White House counsel Don McGahn this past summer, years after the end of the special counsel investigation. The House has not even been able to obtain Donald Trump's tax returns, something that Democrats have been fighting to get access to since they took the majority in 2018. After repeated appeals from the former president, despite repeated defeats in courts of law. According to sources close to the former president, Donald Trump and his aides insist they're not engaged in a ploy to stymie the investigation, though they admit to doing just that in private discussions. The sources said when the Select Committee issued its first subpoenas to its former aides Mark Meadows, Dan Scavino, Steve Bannon and Kash Patel, Trump's lawyers told their lawyers to defy the orders because it would likely serve to slow down the investigation. The result of Trump's directive, first reported by The Guardian, is that Steve Bannon and Mark Meadows refused to appear for their depositions, and the Select Committee now may never hear their inside information about the Capitol attack after they were held in contempt of Congress. It remains possible that Steve Bannon and Mark Meadows seek some kind of a plea deal with federal prosecutors that involves providing testimony to the Select Committee in exchange for no jail time. But, for instance, the court hearing for Steve Bannon is scheduled late into the summer. The reality for House investigators is that the cases are now in the hands of a Justice Department intent on proving it remains above the political fray, after years of Donald Trump's interference at the Department of Justice, and therefore indifferent to the time crunch felt by the 6th of January House Committee. The situation for the Select Committee may be even trickier with Republican members of Congress involved in 6th of January, as they just need to stonewall the investigation only through to the midterm elections, before which the panel hopes to release an interim report into their findings. A spokesperson for the House Select Committee declined to comment on the outlook for the investigation and their expectations for the Supreme Court hearing in the case against Donald Trump, which the panel, cognizant of their limited time frame, has asked to expedite. Benny Thompson, the chairman of the Select Committee, originally aimed to have the final report completed before the midterm elections, but the efforts by the most senior Trump officials to delay the investigation means he could need until the end of the year. But either way, sources close to the investigation are saying that the Select Committee is hoping that the Supreme Court will deliver the elusive Trump White House records and that it could pave the way for the investigation to shift into yet another higher gear.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulullah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you, Rasulullah. أعوذ
بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Dear brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته You are welcome to Like Muhammad with me, Javed Akbari. We are going to discuss some of the qualities and some of the moral characteristics of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, based on some reports that are found and that you can find, obviously, in the Shia and Sunni sources. Some of the most important sources are Al-Kafi and Man La Hadhuru Al-Faqih, and of course you can find it in Sunan Al-Nabi and Mahajatul Bayda, and all these books are there also in Nahj Al-Fasaha. These are some books that you can find important traditions about the Prophet's lifestyle and sayings. The Prophet's lifestyle, Prophet's tradition includes his actions, his sayings, and even his silence are authoritative. They have the probative force, which means that we have to follow in the footsteps of the Prophets and we have to act according to his tradition. We should be practicing adherence of the Prophet's tradition. When it comes to the Prophet's silence, some of our audience and listeners may not understand what it means. How can the Prophet's silence be authoritative? Now, I give you an example. If you are doing an action, suppose the Prophet were present at this time, the Prophet was sitting there and you were doing an action, and the Prophet did not object to you. He did not say anything to you, but he was silent. He remained silent. Given the fact that the Prophet witnessed your practice, he saw how you offered your prayer, he saw how you behaved with your friends, he saw how you conducted yourself, and the Prophet did not object to it. He could object to it because he had the free will and the volition to object, but he did not object. So this means that the Prophet, in fact, approved of that act and he endorsed it indirectly, though he did not utter any word, did not say anything. So that's how silence becomes an authoritative factor. Silence of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. The same is the case with the other infallibles, of course, the 14 infallibles and holy imams, the infallible imams. When they see something and they do not object, then that means that they approve of that act, and that act is permissible, there is no objection in it, and it is allowable. Let's take a break and then we will be back.
ربنا عليك قدرا يا إمام الأنبياء يا حبيبي يا محمد يا نبي سلام عليك يا رسول سلام عليك يا حبيب سلام عليك صلوات الله عليك.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. I am Javed Akbari. Now, brothers and sisters, let us talk about the Prophet's dealings with the people. It has been related that Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam said, I asked my father, the commander faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, about how the Prophet of Allah, peace be upon him, and his family would spend his time indoors. The commander of faithful, replying to Imam Hussain, said he would divide his time into three parts, one part for God, one part for his family, and one part for himself. Then the part that was for him, he would divide between himself and the people. Those people were people who were close to him and the general public. It did not matter. He would spare all the time that he could for them. What does it mean that the Prophet, in fact, divided his time and he gave one third of his time to people also, to his close relatives? His policy or his approach or maybe his lifestyle regarding the time he set aside for the Muslim community was to occupy them with what would benefit them and benefit the Muslim community. So he would go to them asking them after their health, he would ask them if they had any problem, and he would get information about their needs or about what had to be done. So he would try to solve their problems. He would reach out to those who were desperate, if there were any, of course. Of course, there were many Muslims in the holy city of Medina who were in need of help, who were in need of support. And the Prophet and his companions would go out looking for them and trying to help them as much as he could. Now, you can find this hadith. The hadith is very lengthy. You can find this hadith in Sunan al-Nabi, of course, page 14. And this is a hadith that has been reported from Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam on the authority of his father. And the hadith continues. Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam relates. He says that, then I asked my father about how the apostle of God, the Prophet, spent his time outside the house. He said, the Prophet of Allah, may Allah bless him and his family, of course, would guard his tongue except in matters that concerned him. He would work to unite the people and not divide them. He would honor the nobles of every people and place them in authority over them, the nobles of the Muslim community. So it, because in the early period of time or in the early period of Islam, the Arab society was divided into communities and tribes and clans. So there were some people who led the communities. So the Prophet actually did his best to work with those people, and he would honor the nobles of the people, placing them in authority, placing them or putting them as leaders of the people, because every community or every clan needs to have a leader. Without a leader, it is simply impossible to guide the community, to lead or to take the matters in, to handle the affairs of the Muslim society. Whether the society is Muslim or non-Muslim, it does not make any difference. Every community, every people need a leader. Without leadership, of course, the society, there will be chaos, there will be mayhem, there will be destruction, and there will be lawlessness. That's not what Islam wants.
My heart is so full of longing. I wish to be close to my beloved. I dream to walk in the streets of Medina and to quench the thirst of my spirit by visiting you, O Muhammad.
The Prophet of Islam, in fact, would warn the people against the discourse. He would be on his guard with the people at all times, but he would never withhold from them his smile or good manners. He would miss those of his companions who were absent and would ask the people about the affairs of the people and would encourage what was beautiful and good and discourage what was ugly and bad. So this was what the Prophet did when he gave his time to the people. The Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him, and his family was balanced and did not go to extremes. Of course, he would never become heedless for fear that the people would become heedless and divert from the right path, because it is very bad when you are heedless. People will start following you and divert from the right path. So the Prophet of Islam was prepared for every possible scenario and for every situation, and would not fall short of the truth nor go beyond it. So in his view, of course, the best of them were those who gave the best counsel and the highest in station. The best of them and the highest, of course, among them were those who gave the best solidarity and the best support. So dear brothers and sisters, that's all for this episode. Until next session, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Be like Muhammad and live like Muhammad and give like Muhammad did. Shafi'ullah, Habibullah, Nabiullah, Rasulullah, Khalil.
In the limelight.
Mounting challenges will make the coming months critical for the President Biden's environmental agenda, analysts say. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Lisa Friedman, who reports on federal climate and environmental policy. The piece is titled, Biden Overpromised and Underdelivered on Climate. Now trouble looms in 2022. Opens, President Biden faces an increasingly narrow path to fulfill his ambitious goal of slashing the greenhouse gases generated by the United States that are helping to warm the planet to dangerous levels. His Build Back Better Act, which contains $555 billion in proposed climate action, is in limbo on Capitol Hill. The Supreme Court is set to hear a pivotal case in February that could significantly restrict his authority to regulate the carbon dioxide that spews from power plants and is driving climate change. And the midterm elections loom in November, threatening his party's control of Congress. Since Republicans have shown little appetite for climate action, A Republican takeover of one or both chambers could freeze movement for years. The mounting challenges make the next few months critical to secure the safety of the planet as well as President Biden's climate legacy, analysts are saying. If they can't pull this off, then we have failed. The country has failed the climate test, said John Podesta, a former senior counselor to President Barack Obama and founder of the Center for American Progress, a left-leaning think tank. Mr. Podesta praised the Biden administration for making a global warming a priority, creating a White House Office of Domestic Climate Policy, appointing an international climate envoy to reassert U.S. leadership on the global stage, moving forward a handful of regulations and proposing major investments in clean energy. But John Podesta also noted that the physics of climate change is unforgiving. The planet has already warmed an average of 1.1 degrees Celsius compared with the temperatures before the Industrial Revolution. If temperatures continue to rise past 1.5 degrees Celsius, the likelihood of the increasingly deadly wildfires, floods, heat waves and other disasters becomes unavoidable, scientists have warned. Countries must immediately and drastically reduce their greenhouse gas emissions caused by burning of fossil fuels such as oil, gas and coal if the world is to avert the most catastrophic impacts, experts are saying. At international climate talks in Glasgow last year, President Biden pledged that the United States, the world's biggest polluter in historical terms, would cut its emissions at least 50% below 2005 levels by the end of this decade. He urged other countries to take similar steps, but that will be a hard sell if the United States fails to act by the time countries gather for the next climate talks in Egypt this November. If you can't meet the goal, you've lost credibility internationally, John Podesta said, adding that he would grade Joe Biden's first year on climate policy as an incomplete. When he entered the White House, Joe Biden identified climate change as one of four priorities, along with battling the coronavirus pandemic, strengthening the economy, and addressing racial inequity. It was a dramatic reversal after the tenure of President Donald Trump, who frequently mocked climate science, sought to expand oil and gas drilling, and loosened a raft of environmental regulations, including those governing greenhouse gas emissions. The most important thing that Joe Biden did was to draw a sharp contrast with his predecessor within the first days of his presidency, said Senator Chris Coons, Democrat of Delaware, who has close ties to President Biden. Mr. Biden immediately rejoined the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, in which nearly 200 countries pledged to try to hold temperature rise well below 2 degrees Celsius. He cancelled permits for the Keystone XL pipeline, which would have run 1,209 miles from the Canadian oil sands to Nebraska. He paused new leases for oil and gas drilling on public lands and in federal waters, and called for increasing renewable energy production, with the goal of doubling offshore wind power by 2030. Joe Biden installed longtime climate advocates in key positions and made tackling the climate crisis a priority across the federal government. The early flurry of efforts culminated in a virtual summit in April, at which Joe Biden corralled world leaders to make new pledges to cut carbon dioxide emissions. On Capitol Hill, though, President Biden led passage of a $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill that included billions for clean energy research and making communities more resilient to disasters, although it will do little to reduce carbon emissions. However, cracks in President Biden's agenda quickly appeared. In June, a federal judge in Louisiana sided with the Republican attorneys general from 13 states who argued that Joe Biden lacked the legal authority to pause new oil and gas leases. As gasoline prices surged in the summer and fall, the White House sought to increase oil production, even as President Biden implored world leaders to stop burning fossil fuels. Just days after the Glasgow climate talks, the Biden administration auctioned off nearly 80 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico, a record for that location, for offshore drilling, despite a campaign promise by Joe Biden that he would end drilling on federal lands and federal waters. White House officials said they were legally compelled to hold the lease sale, which the Interior Department said had the potential to yield 1.12 billion barrels of oil and 4.4 trillion cubic feet of natural gas over the life of the 50-year leases. But environmental groups, joined by several Democratic lawmakers, argue that the Biden administration could have done a lot more to prevent the sale and are suing the administration to stop it. Most notably, Joe Biden failed to persuade the single Democratic holdout, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, to vote for his $1.7 trillion Build Back Better bill, placing its future in jeopardy in an evenly split Senate. The House passed the package back in November. In negotiations with the White House, Joe Manchin insisted that the Biden administration strip out the most muscular part of the bill, a clean electricity program that would have rewarded electric utilities that stopped burning fossil fuels in favor of wind, solar, and other clean energy, and penalized those that did not. Joe Manchin also scuttled a provision that would have prohibited most offshore oil drilling. The legislation still contains about $555 billion for other climate provisions, including $320 billion in tax incentives for producers and purchasers of wind power, solar power, and nuclear power, inducements intended to speed up a transition away from oil, gas, and coal. Analysts say it would help the United States to get at least halfway to Joe Biden's climate goals. The future of the legislation remains uncertain, although Senate Democrats said on Tuesday that they were determined to see some version of it passed this year. Objectively, he overpromised and underdelivered, said Kevin Book, managing director of Clearview Energy Partners, a Washington-based research firm. Still, Kevin Book added, while the administration did not do as much as President Biden had promised, it has taken significant first steps. However, many activists are saying they were disenchanted with the president. Joe Biden started strong with the executive actions back in January, and since then he has really been a disappointment, said Ellen Scales, a spokeswoman for the Sunrise Movement, a youth-led environmental group that helped spur a jump in young voters concerned about climate in 2020. Ellen Scales said she feared it would be difficult to turn out those voters again in November. He made a lot of promises on cutting emissions, and we question whether or not that's on track, she said, adding that it was a slap in the face to environmentalists when Joe Biden went to Glasgow to declare the United States a climate leader, only to quickly lease millions of acres in the Gulf of Mexico to oil and gas companies for drilling. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has been slow to make progress on major new environmental regulations, in part because agencies were hollowed out during the Trump administration, leaving a crush of work to fewer people. Manish Bapna, president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental group, said he saw 2022 as a make-or-break year. Most of the hard work remains ahead of us, Manish Bapna said.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
I'm here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in today's episode, we're aiming for a deep dive into domestic politics of the United States in the year 2021. We will focus on several key issues, some of which have been covered less than they should by mainstream media. My guests for this episode are Emilio Viano, political analyst based in Washington, D.C., as well as Professor Paul Sheldon out of Irvine, California. Stay tuned.
Is the United States losing its power, or is it approaching a civil war? These are some of the questions that kept the minds of analysts and normal people busy in the past year. The year 2021 was filled with hope and concerns over a range of controversial issues. The pandemic, the hate that was highlighted along with it, and spread of disinformation for political gain. The year was indeed a defining one, in which fears and reckoning mingled to project a future to come that could be either dark or bright. Facing with crisis after crisis, the nation is facing a new year in which the prophecies could be waiting to be fulfilled. The uncertain future in the upcoming year could indeed shape the life of Americans for decades to come.
The year 2021, which began with presidency of Democrat Joe Biden, appears to have been not much more different from the years of the Trump era, at least in the immigration sector. President Biden has been struggling to tackle the country's broken immigration system, but some analysts believe his efforts have not made much real change. Controversy over the southern border was kept fresh, probably culminating during the harrowing deportation of Haitian immigrants and refugee seekers from the United States, which shocked the world despite outcry from human rights advocates from both inside and outside America.
The immigration issue is a very hot issue here in the U.S., especially among the more conservative segment of the population. The ex-president, the former President Trump, has described them, for example, as criminals, as people who come here to rape, to steal, to kill, and most of all to take away jobs from Americans. Biden has tried to correct that. He has proposed three major bills, three major new laws earlier this year. One has to do with the so-called Dreamers. These are people who grew up in this country, having been brought here as children by their parents. So there is the argument that It is not their fault that they are here. The parents took them here when they were children. Secondly, they grew up here, so they learn the values of this society and they belong here. They don't have, at times, they don't even speak the language of the country they came from. Then there is another that has to do with the temporal workers, the temporary workers, particularly in agriculture. We are talking about 200,000 people seasonally.
Programs such as DACA, which was created under former President Barack Obama in 2012, were also subjected to power play among the most powerful factions, from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle to the White House and the Supreme Court. President Biden indeed needs to take action in the coming year to ameliorate the country's malfunctioning immigration system. How could U.S. immigration in the year 2021 be described, and where is the immigration system heading onward?
Coronavirus stopping the economy starting again with a lot of desire to buy, to travel, to improve one's lifestyle, etc. And the fact that it's been hard to bring back people to work. That is the other element here. Many people have not returned to work because they feel that they deserve better pay, better benefits, and therefore they are looking for better jobs, or they start their own job, their own business. And this has made it also difficult at the harbors, west and east coast, to unload their shipments. So here also there has been an attempt by Biden to make the wages higher, the minimum wages higher. Of course, he has been limited to people that have contracts with the federal government.
Trust in U.S. media has been eroding steadily in the past decade, and 2021 was no exception. With partisanship and tribalism peaking, the American nation came closer to the reckoning that media outlets are no place to seek truth and objective reporting. With the Democratic administration in power, the leftist media basically condoned the glitches in the system by reminding viewers of the dark Trump era.
On the other hand, the conservative media missed no chance to pillage every single progressive move by the liberals in power, whether in the White House or chambers of Congress. Consequently, accurate and reliable information is harder to come by than ever, and disinformation abounds. But how is the status of trust in U.S. media and the significance of rise in disinformation in such critical times?
Recent surveys show that a large percentage of Americans do not trust the mainstream media. However, they're still watching it. They wouldn't be mainstream media unless millions of people were tuning in. So what they really mean is they distrust the networks that they don't like, but they trust the one they watch. So I'm not impressed by those surveys.
Following the death of George Floyd under the knee of a police officer in the summer of 2020, the year 2021 became an important one for the movement. The national reckoning brought an increasing number of Americans to the streets in the largest movement in U.S. history.
All right, we can do
course
support.
Okay, I just want to keep being.
Excuse me.
The situation.
I saw you
grab him. I saw you deliberately escalate the situation.
I love you, Kane.
You grabbed him. I love you, Kane. By the shirt.
I love you, Kane. What's he being arrested for?
The year was still marked with incidents of African Americans falling victim in the hands of mostly white police officers. The movement continued in the past year, probably stronger as ever, in the nation's quest to put an end to police brutality against the people of color.
We, the jury, in the above entitled matter, as to count one, unintentional second degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April 2021 at 1:44 p.m. Signed, juror foreperson, juror number 19. Same caption, verdict count two. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter, as to count two, third degree murder, perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April 2021 at 1:45 p.m. Signed by jury foreperson, juror number 19.
Now, the U.S. economy was hit with inflation and disruption in supply chains in 2021 as the COVID-19 pandemic continued raging across the country. There were, however, reports of improved labor market conditions with industrial production allegedly rising compared to the previous year. The U.S. economy is said to have expanded an annualized 2.1% on the third quarter of 2021.
Well, the U.S. economy surprisingly has weathered COVID and inflation fairly well up to this point. The trick will be, can that be repeated next year in the event of the passage of massive deficit legislation, endless war spending, and all the other problems of inflation getting worse and so forth. So far, relative to many other countries in the world, America has come out fairly well in spite of all of these problems. Part of it, I think, is because we have 50 states, and states can make their own rules on a lot of things.
On the whole, relaxing lockdowns and stay-in-place orders at the beginning of the year seems to have had a positive influence on the markets, as many Americans returned to work and gained a better purchasing power. So, how could the U.S. economy be evaluated in the past year, particularly the rise of inflation and disruption in the supply chain?
Did distort reality didn't present the facts as they should be, and mostly depicted a situation where they criticized anyone that was not in tune with President Trump as being someone that threatened the future of the country, didn't help America become great again, and should be condemned. So there is an enormous division in this country between those that follow the mainstream media, let's call them that way, and those who follow the more right-wing-oriented media. There is, of course, also some left-wing-oriented media, but it's not very developed.
The year 2021 saw a return of anti-vaxxers and anti-maskers to the mainstream media for good reasons. With mandatory vaccination and mask mandates, the people poured out into the streets in different towns and cities in protest. Anti-vaccination tendencies have existed in the U.S. almost since the idea of vaccination started, but last year it culminated amid the coronavirus pandemic.
Definitely that has been a very serious problem in this country, a deep division between people that have totally rejected being vaccinated and have contributed, of course, to the long run of COVID-19 in this country. What might be helping a little bit is that the new variation of coronavirus, Omicron, that is now threatening the health of thousands of Americans in this country, might be helpful because it is easier at this point for President Biden and anyone, governors, mayors, people that work in the field, to say, look, it is clear that if you are not vaccinated, you are facilitating the long life of the coronavirus in our country.
Anti-vaxxers believe that people should be free to decide on their own whether they want to get the jab or not. They also consider the mask mandate as a violation of their civil liberty. The COVID-19 pandemic brought an increasing number of anti-vaxxers forward, perhaps more than had been anticipated. What did we learn about anti-vaxxers and anti-maskers in the year 2021, and what is next for such movements, considering the fact that the COVID-19 pandemic is yet to be tackled?
It is your duty as a citizen to yourself, to your family, to your neighbors, to your co-workers, to fellow citizens, to get vaccinated, so that we can beat this illness and not give it any place where it can land. So Omicron can can really help quite a bit in showing that it is the non-vaccinated that are in majority, in over 90%, becoming ill of coronavirus now. And so it is a direct threat to them. It is easier to identify as a population. It is also easier to point out how unreasonable and how dangerous and how unpatriotic and how uncaring it is and how unfair it is to their family, their co-workers, their fellow citizens.
The past year laid bare the new depths of infighting in U.S. politics. Gap seems to be widening despite one party's grip over the main centers of power. Republicans and Democrats refuse to cooperate with the former, sticking to their agenda mostly at the state level. The best place to witness infighting among liberals, however, was Congress, where figures such as Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema swam against the Democratic stream, in part by presenting hurdles to the U.S. president's social spending and climate package agendas.
Infighting was also reported in the conservative camp, mostly in relation to the stance politicians took in regard to the January 6th storming of the Capitol by Trump supporters. Some of the Republicans have staunchly supported the idea of a stolen election, while others believe it is time to move on. Such infighting waves are expected to play a major role in the upcoming 2022 midterm elections. What is with the rift in U.S. politics, coupled with hate and partisanship?
America's chaotic and poorly planned withdrawal from Afghanistan harmed Washington's credit, not only in the international arena, but also at home. President Joe Biden finally kept a long promise by American leaders to end the war in the impoverished country, but at the expense of giving the country back to a strengthened Taliban faction.
I cannot promise what the final outcome will be, or what it will be that it will be without risk of loss. But as Commander-in-Chief, I can assure you that I will mobilize every resource necessary. This is one of the largest, most difficult airlifts in history, and the only country in the world capable of projecting this much power on the far side of the world with this degree of precision is the United States of America.
The year 2021 made Americans reconsider the U.S. adventurism across the world, tainted with shame and silence emanating from failure overseas. After more than 20 years of military presence in Afghanistan, Washington failed to bring about any real change and had to leave in disgrace, a fact that became increasingly evident for the people in the past year.
And now it's Abbas Montarim's turn to share his views on what took place in America in 2021.
Has been another year of American imperialism, settler colonialism, and capitalism. Today on Power to the People, we're going to examine 2021 and particularly look at how Biden and the Democrats have consistently failed the people this year. This year marked the first year of having Donald Trump out of office. To liberals, he was this boogeyman and was the worst thing that has happened to quote-unquote American democracy, as if America itself isn't a genocidal country that was founded on the enslavement of African people. Liberals campaigned useless slogans like anyone but Trump, and consequently, America ended up with another warmongering imperialist as president. Joe Biden, who like his old boss Barack Obama, he campaigned on this notion of change and bringing America back to its so-called international greatness. But if we look at his presidency so far, it's been similar to Trump, and I'd argue it's been worse. We were promised that science would be the decision-making guide in the COVID-19 pandemic. Yet over 380,000 people have died from COVID since Biden has taken office, and that's with having a whole vaccine available. And now, the Omicron variant has been plaguing the country, and Biden himself, he had the opportunity to stock up at-home tests, but he refused to do so and said that there is no federal solution to COVID-19, which makes sense on why there's been so little done by Biden to combat this fast-spreading variant. The CDC under Biden has also limited quarantine from 10 days to 5 days. I guess Biden, he gets to pick and choose what he determines to be his science. The economy under Joe Biden, it's also gotten worse. Inflation has increased, gas prices is hella high, and Biden hasn't forgiven student loans like he has promised. He's about to take $10,000 off of every student's federal student loan debt, and he has failed to keep that promise. Now there's over $1.57 trillion in student loan debt in this country. Joe Biden is also pro-police. Biden himself has, quote, urged states and localities to use the $350 billion granted to them in the $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package to hire more law enforcement officials. And instead of fighting the pandemic, Biden also signed a trio of bipartisan bills that increased spending for the police. And the Department of Justice, they also announced that they will be giving $140 million in grants to local law enforcement. Since George Floyd was murdered by the police, and as of December 26th, 1,646 people have been killed by the police. Since Biden's election, talk of police murder by the mainstream media and the general public has rapidly declined. If this was all happening under Trump, I'm sure we would be hearing about it. But propaganda has allowed for the Democrats to somehow be considered as less racist than these Republicans. These Democrats and their propaganda, it often looks like them promising change to reform, as if reform itself isn't a form of fascism. If we look in Oakland, California, a city that is ran by these Democrats, the city council, they once pledged that they would make change and make reform by defunding the police. But in reality, these Democrats, along with the Democratic mayor, they have increased the police budget by over $38 million. $38 million. And city council, they also voted to add 2 more police academies and to add 60 more police officers. Biden and these Democrats, they is clearly pro-police and anti-abolition, and it must be understood that these Democrats, just like the Republicans, they back the blue, and we cannot let the rhetoric of these Democrats fool us, because they are fascists too. Biden has also continued his legacy of imperialism. While Biden withdrew troops from Afghanistan, he also froze the funds for Afghanistan, and the nation is on a brink of large-scale starvation, as 23 million Afghans, they need food assistance, and 8.7 million are nearing famine. Biden is also responsible for the drone strike in Afghanistan that killed Afghan children. In total, Biden signed a $770 billion budget for the military, which was an increase from Trump's military spending. Biden, he also approved the sale of $735 million in precision-guided weapons to the illegal Israeli occupation. He also sold $650 million worth of missiles to Saudi Arabia, which is dropping bombs on the people of Yemen with the help of the U.S. and European allies. Biden has also kept illegal Trump-era sanctions on Iran. I guess it's safe to say that America is back, and realistically, of that imperialist America, it never left. It is essential for us to believe, for us to not believe, that the Democrats will bring the change that is necessary for our communities to be free. To be free under the Democrats' rule in itself is an oxymoron. As Julius Nyerere said, the United States is a one-party state, but with typical American extravagance, they have two of them. Many people, they argue that Biden is the less evil choice compared to Trump. But evil is still evil, and Biden's actions in his first year, whether it be him giving billions of dollars to the police and funding, or him refusing to effectively combat the COVID-19 pandemic, it shows that he is loyal to the immoral and anti-human principles of imperialism, capitalism, and settler colonialism. This is Power to the People, and I'll see y'all next year, inshallah.
That was our show. Thank you. Please tune in next week for another episode of We the People. Wish you a better year. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Goodbye and Happy New Year, everyone.
This is A to Z. an introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the family cause of peace. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of the family being the cause of peace. Now, we know that husband and wife are the main roles in the family, and they play the main role in the family. Therefore, according to the Islamic teachings, it is emphasized very much that they both should live with love, and they should think about each other as being one person. They should not think about each other as they're two different people. Rather, they are just one, and together they should manage the family, because when they manage family together, then their wordings will be one, and the others from outside and even kids from inside the house, they will see that whenever it's about the family, they always have one wording, and therefore they're managing this family, which is a small family, a small part of society, as one person, and they are united. And therefore, we, in such a family, it can be clearly seen that there is a kind of unity in the family. There is a kind of love in the family, which is not found anywhere else. And this is very important, that the families are having coordination with each other, the husband and wife having coordination with each other. And this coordination and this unity will bring the peace within the family. Therefore, it is necessary to have such a coordination. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of family, the cause of peace. And Islam is emphasizing a lot on this topic. And it says that the husband and wife should live as one person. They should love each other. Even we have the narration from the Prophet ﷺ in which he said, قَوْلُ الرَّجُلِي لِإِمْرَأَةٍ, that if a man says to his wife, Inni uhibbuke, I love you a lot, or I love you, la yadhhabu min qalbiha abada. This wording which he has said, I love you, or I love you the most, it never goes away from, it is never removed from her heart. It never goes away from her heart. Therefore, we also need to do some psychology here. And the psychology which we need here is that there's a difference between a man and woman. And in the family, we should pay attention to this point as well, that the ladies or women, they need to hear from the husband. They more like to hear things from the husband. For example, the wordings as such as I love you, I like you, and the praises. Obviously, when there is something, when she cooks something, obviously you praise for the food, for her dress, for her maybe makeup, or the way she talks. So this is the psychology of the women, that the women or the ladies, they love to hear the praise, their praises from the husbands. On the other hand, for the woman and female, they should know that the men more likely loves the practical aspect, that if the wife is saying I love you, this is not enough. She should practically show maybe the affection, or you know, with the practically they should get involved. And this is what the males are usually, generally males are like this, men are like this, and generally the women are become happy with the wordings which a husband says, and